Hi, Matt.
Hi, Mark.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I think to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the executive editor of the American Prospect magazine.
And I'm Matthew Iglesias, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Okay. And once upon a time at this august publication.
Indeed. Before your time.
Before my time.
Back in the good old days.
The good old days, I know. All they ever do around here is talk about it. The good old days. Tired of it.
Yeah. And we need to look forward, you know.
Right. Exactly. So did you see that press conference last night?
Almost none of it.
Yeah, me too. Almost none of it. I was playing Trivial Pursuit with my daughter and her stuffed animals.
Well, there you go. That's good. I was having dinner with libertarians.
Oh, good. Dinner with libertarians. Yeah, I've been going to those dinners, but I missed that one.
Right. Apparently, you know, I did come back and read the coverage, and a lot of people seemed surprised that the president didn't get any questions about this plan that was kind of rolled out over the weekend and on Monday to establish public-private partnerships with hundreds of billions of dollars in buying and presumably save the banking system, which seems important.
It is very important. It's very important. It's kind of been all anybody's been talking about for the previous 2 days.
Well, and it was actually...
I think he alluded to it a little bit, but he didn't get the specific... I mean, he kind of worked it into some of his answers, I think. I read the transcript.
Right. But it's particularly curious, because after several weeks long sort of media freakout about the fact that they hadn't announced details of this plan, but still wanted to talk about their budget, they announced details of the plan, and reporters didn't seem to have anything to ask about it.
Right.
You know, possibly I appreciate that this is, it's complicated, and I think over the heads of even a lot of intelligent people, most of whom are not in the White House press corps to begin with.
I mean, being in the White House press corps is a particular job. You're just paying attention to what's happening in the White House.
The only
kind of people who can understand, who have something to say about the banking plan, are people who are kind of immersed in economics and finance reporting.
Right. Although it also, in part, I think, reflects the fact that the administration seems to have very deliberately distanced the president personally from one of the key planks of his administration's agenda.
Right. Although he did go out and say a few words about it when the day Geithner announced it.
He did. I mean, it's not that he's disavowed it, but I mean, there has been a conscious effort to get this labeled as Geithner's plan, and to split it, and to some extent, you know, that's been, I think, some more progressive people who are not necessarily enthusiastic about this plan, but who like other aspects of the administration agenda, have been eager to go along with this, too, with this kind of strange fiction that there's, like, two different Obama administrations.
Right, there's that
One of which is led by Tim Geithner and is doing this stuff, and another of which is maybe led by Peter Orszag and wants to create universal health care. I mean, obviously, in any people disagree about things, but this is, an important initiative that... It's not like Tim Geithner did this without anyone at the White House noticing.
Right, absolutely. And it's also not like you can do this, say, oh, that didn't work, now we'll do universal health care.
I mean, you need this to work for
all the other things to work. Plus, you need the economy to work. I mean, I think one of the smartest things that I've seen said about this is that all the bet that people are making when they buy these so-called toxic assets or legacy securities, they're not necessarily making a bet on that individual package of mortgages or whatever it is contained in that security. They're really making a bet on the broader economy.
I've seen, you know, talking to people, there's strong empirical disagreement about the question of what would people do if they bought houses near the peak, then their house, the value of their house has fallen enough that they owe more on their loan than the house is worth.
Right.
But they don't lose their jobs.
Right.
You know, they're not incapable of making the mortgage payment.
Right.
It just doesn't make strict sense to pay off, you know, a giant loan when your house, when the total value of the house is only 60% of the loan.
Right.
And there's one school of thought that says, well, you know, people, you know, they're living in their houses, and insofar as people can afford to make the payments in a reasonable way, they will continue to do it, and therefore, if the economy recovers, people will have money, they'll make their monthly payments, and
right.
some of the securities will go bust, but most of them will go forward. Another school of thought, though, says no, that the actual value of these securities is very closely linked to the actual value of the underlying value of the homes. And there's really nothing – I mean, we're not going to cause GDP to double in the next 3 years. And so, you know, house prices are going to continue to stay lower than
right.
they had been.
Right.
I have, like – of the various uncertainties surrounding this, I don't think anyone has any idea how to even resolve that question.
Right, but in neither case, I mean, there is a tone that you get from, I mean, you know, what you get from Paul Krugman and some of the sharpest critics is the word worthless. All these things are worthless.
Right.
Well, even if large numbers of people are underwater on their mortgages,
right,
you know, that doesn't make that mortgage worthless. Finding
no,
you know,
no. I mean,
and you may need a system to renegotiate capital, which to renegotiate the principal, which they have in some cases, and then you actually get to the actual value. I mean, if these things are worth 70% of what they think they are, that's huge. I mean, that's going to be an enormous windfall for somebody. Or if ultimately they are priced at that level. I mean, I think the bigger question is what. The securities that I think are potentially worthless are those that are three levels beyond the actual mortgage.
Uh-huh.
You know, the things that are almost just a bet, obviously credit default swaps, but things that look more like a second level bet on the mortgage, or something that's packaged out of, let's say, you know, I don't even know all the different kinds of securities that are created, but something that's created out of the stream of payments on adjustable rate mortgages after they reset. I mean, presumably
right.
they separated out the pre-reset and then the post-reset stream of payments. Obviously, there might be things like that that are worthless. But I mean, there's definitely value here. You know, it's interesting. I'm reading this new book about Bear Stearns and the collapse
right.
of Bear Stearns, and
right.
it's a very good. It's a great book. It's, you know, a bunch of scoundrels, but. The big killings in the history of Bear Stearns, you realize, were all just having the guts to buy a bunch of securities that at the time seemed worthless.
Right.
There were railroad securities in World War II because the railroads were prohibited from paying interest on their bonds.
Right, right,
bonds.
Right.
And New York City Municipal bonds in the 70s before the mm-hmm. financial mm-hmm. rescue plan. You know, there was no market for them. They bought them, they had the guts to hold them, and till there was suddenly a market, they made the market and they made a killing. And those are sort of the two great events. And it's really a reminder, like, yes, somebody is going to make a killing here. And that somebody
right.
is looking around saying, who's going to put up some money for me to make this killing? And ultimately, only the U.S. government was able to come in and put up that money. That's how I sort of see it. That's how I see
right.
it.
Right. I mean, I think, as best I can tell, that's about right. I mean, I think the better concern that's been raised about this is the one raised by Simon Johnson and some others, which is that even if this works in some sense, it's not clear what it gets us to exactly.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, it's important, obviously, to not have these large institutions just fail in a chaotic way that bankrupts all kinds of other institutions, but there seems to be a certain sense, it seems to me, that some people on Wall Street, people in the kind of finance media complex and political, this is very sort of inbred, you know, elites in both parties, economic policy making on Wall Street, in CNBC, and so on and so forth, and they really want to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Right.
When, you know, the story of this scenario isn't just that, well, crises happen, but it's that actually the profits that were being made over the past few years were fake.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's that, and it's weird because these people, since individuals involved were in fact able to pocket large salaries, they are still wealthy and powerful people, just the way that the founders of Google and Microsoft and so forth are. But unlike those guys, they didn't actually create anything of value. So having them go back to doing business like they were in 2004, 2005 isn't going to achieve anything. And also, I mean, they're not going to do it, right? I mean,
right.
If you recapitalize the banks, it's not like Vikram Pandit is going to turn around and say, oh, you know what we should do is make a lot of bets based on the proposition that home prices will never fall.
Right.
But I mean, but that's their business model. I take it that if Citigroup and Bank of America had known of some other great way to make money, you know, they would have been doing that. So I don't know.
They did that too. AIG obviously had its normal way of making lots of money, and then it had this crazy way that seemed to make a little more money that nobody really understood. I mean, the story of every one of these institutions is there's a guy at the top who doesn't really understand this new way of doing things, and it seems like it's making money, so he's fine with it. I mean, these story. There's almost a boring quality to, like, you know, a few months ago there was a story of Bob Rubin at Citi and Greenberg at AIG or whatever. You know, they're basically older guys who are like, this is beyond me. I never took that level of math, and seems to be profitable, but it seems a little spooky, and they let it happen.
Right. But I mean, it's also a question about I think, you know, kinds of institutions. And if you talk to people involved in small banks, you know, they will say, well, you know, we make money by making loans to, you know, mortgages, which are based on a certain analytic formula, which is a little dull. And they also make loans to businesses, and that's based on sitting down with the people and reading their business plans and making a judgment about the viability of the project and the creditworthiness of the borrower. And they say, you know, if their bank was gigantic, then nobody would know what people were doing, even if the math involved wasn't that complicated. And I heard the same thing from some shady Swiss bankers in Geneva who were involved in very complicated stuff. But they were saying, you know, so our firm said to me, you know, it's a partnership with unlimited liability.
Right.
So, you know, I don't want there to be 10,000 partners.
Right.
Because if someone screws up, then I lose all my money.
Right.
So they keep it small and they're paying attention. Whereas when you move to this conglomerate model, the CEO earns more money the bigger his bank gets.
Right, right.
So there's this incentive to just kind of grow it beyond, you know, no human being could possibly have been overseeing all those different units of AIG.
Right. Yeah. I guess the point is, obviously, there are some people who sort of think, oh, we'll just kind of get this thing going again. We'll get these securities moving again, and then it's back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's not back to business as usual. And yet, I don't think you can say, I've just become sort of a total centrist softy lately, but I don't think that you can say everything that happened in the securitization of mortgages and everything else, which really had an enormous effect of making credit available to people. I mean, I don't think you could say all that was just garbage. I mean, there's a lot of value was created in constructing financial markets where they didn't exist before.
Right, but I don't think there's any real reason to think that there was value in allowing institutions of such unprecedented scale to be assembled.
Right.
You know, that there was a real I think that, you know, some of the old rules started to look silly to people because they were arbitrary.
Right.
You know, like, why could your bank have as many branches as you wanted all throughout the giant state of California, but it couldn't operate in both
right.
South Dakota
right.
and North Dakota, right?
Right.
I mean, obviously
right.
that doesn't, you know, like, make sense, quote
right.
unquote.
Right. And if you look at it, it only was the law because, you know, because at one point, right, Patman, who was kind of a crazy populist, was the chair of the, I guess, the House Banking Committee.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
but
it's very arbitrary little... legacy
right.
of history. And same with Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall didn't make, which separated investment banks from commercial banks. You know, by the 90s, it was really hard to say, yes, this makes a lot, this is a sacred American principle.
Right.
But it did have the effect. Things didn't get
right.
too big, yeah.
Right. I mean, what we can see in retrospect was that the existence of these rules, sort of apart from the particular logic of the rules, kept the institutions of a manageable scale so that when institutions failed, they could be resolved
right.
in an orderly manner.
Right.
That even during the S&L crisis,
right.
it was expensive to bail those banks out, but there
right.
wasn't this logistical problem where people
right.
are saying, on the one hand, well, what we should really do is this, but on the other hand, oh, well, you know, there's not enough inspectors, we don't know how, and that's not... You know, it's very unwise.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, something is going to have to be done about this. And I know coming to the G20 summit, there's this big difference of opinion between the Americans and the English on the one hand and everyone else about the importance of sort of doing this piece with regulatory reform, where
right.
I think the English speakers are taking this extremely literal view that, well, you know, excessive risk taking is not a problem this, like, right now. So
right.
we don't need to think about this regulatory issue.
Right.
And I think it's out of touch with the fact that normal people are freaked out about the situation and would like to see something being done to show that it's being redressed.
Right.
Right. I mean, whether or not, you know, I'm not, right. I don't think anyone thinks that, like, this exact same mistake is going to happen in
right.
August. But
right.
still, I mean, now seems like, now is the time when
yeah,
you could
absolutely.
Ever
right.
pass regulations that bank
right.
executives don't like, that
right.
it would happen.
Right.
So if it doesn't
right.
happen now.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, where are we?
Yeah, I mean, that was the moment where you're not going to have, you know, them all rushing up to the hill and saying you're going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg.
Right.
Right.
And yet, I mean, the administration seems to me to be, I mean, they have a lot on their plate, but that they're being a little oddly passive about this. And in the international context, actually, like, really obdurate about it. And in a way that I'm finding hard to understand. I mean, I don't know what they, you know, they think they're going to do this 3 years from now.
Right.
I don't really know. I think, you know, it's not the party line, but I think there's actually other aspects of this agenda that if you were going to delay something, if you feel you can't do everything at once, that it makes more
right.
sense to say can be done down the road.
Right, right. What would you delay?
But I think, you know, I think some of this education stuff doesn't necessarily need to be done. I am, I don't think that they should delay healthcare reform, but if they think they have to delay something,
yeah.
I think that the sense of emergency around this is a little artificial, and that the official explanations of, like, why it has to be done in 2009 don't totally add up. I mean, I don't really buy
right.
the story that, like, the administration can't move forward on all fronts simultaneously. I think that's one of the few virtues of the congressional committee system,
right.
is that, you know, banking can work on one bill while finance
right.
works on a separate one. But, you know, some of these things, particularly because if you conceded the need to work with Republicans and blah, 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 on all this stuff, you know, things could be done in the second or third year of the administration. Whereas if you're ever going to sort of I don't want to say like smack banks around, but you know, do something.
Right.
That's what really has to be done.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the danger is, I mean, there is such a negative. There's such a. I mean, now we're in the backlash phase of the populist backlash.
Right.
I mean, there is a danger of that it turns into just symbolically slapping banks around. I mean, that you know, the actually getting buckling down and grappling with a new regulatory structure, you know, it's not something that they're ready to do right now. And that, you know, I mean, you know, Arne Duncan can go off and do education stuff. It really doesn't.
Right.
That's all fine. That can all happen at the same time. The economic team has to do the bailout. They have to do the mortgage relief. They have to do, you know, their aspect of the budget. I mean, there's a lot that they have to do that I'm not sure you could do really comprehensive banking reform, you know, like that. But obviously, you have to be ready for it and acknowledge the need for it. And, you know, it's one of the things that Obama was really great about in the campaign.
Right,
you know,
and I don't think...
One of the great speeches of the whole campaign was that, you know, and really grounded in the basic principle of you should be regulated on what you do rather than what you call yourself.
Right, and I mean, I just don't think... I think it should be possible to articulate generic principles.
Right.
Now,
right.
And say that, you know, people are going to need to do this later, but instead, they seem to be... so focused on maintaining a positive relationship with
right.
important Wall Street figures. I mean, you can tell that despite their accurate statements that you should not judge them by the day-to-day fluctuations in the Dow, that I think, you know, a lot of the second unveiling of the Geithner plan was done with the theory that, you know, if they arrange this so as to err on the side of a kind of a taxpayer giveaway, that would, yes, produce a lot of short-term, you know, of complaining from certain sectors, but also
right.
was guaranteed to produce a stock boom, which would then sort of get it declared a success. Whereas, you know, if they say things that make it look like Bank of America's long-term profit outlook is not so good, you know, stocks will go down, markets will be unsettled, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you don't put a couple of rhetorical markers down, you know, I don't see how this sort of gets done later.
So what would you do? What would you have done?
I think I would have said that, you know, we're doing all this stuff because we think it's necessary for the economy to go. But I also think that it is really outrageous that policy mistakes of the past have left us in the situation where we need to do this, that these banks are too big to fail, which is why we need to engage in these bailouts. But the idea of letting banks become too big to fail is crazy, and, you know, we
right.
should not do it. And we are going to instruct people to, you know, and acknowledge the complexity of cashing that out in actual regulatory language and say, you know, it will take time to think about what's the best way to do this, but that the goal will be to have something like the FDIC process for regular-sized banks where, you know, the government is capable of, if necessary, taking them into receivership, disposing of their assets, doing it, you know, without the need for either ad hoc measures or unorthodox infusions of taxpayer cash, because part of the genius of the FDIC system is that it's beneficial to the banks on the whole, and consequently the banks actually pay the money into it, you know, so that while money needs to be expended in these FDIC takeover processes, it's not, you know, it doesn't play as a bailout.
Right.
And it isn't. You know, people are not paying the price for this kind of thing. Instead, we're all ultimately, you know, depositors and bankers benefit from the fact that there's confidence in a
right.
routine stopgap
right.
measure.
Right, right. And of course it creates moral hazard.
What?
It does create moral hazard. I mean, you can take bigger
it
risks
does.
When you have an insurance backup.
Right, but the
but
ability...
But your bank doesn't exist anymore.
Right. So,
right.
you know, and so the ability of banks to take some kind of risks with their money is beneficial. And, you know, ultimately it means that you do have to decide as a bank manager, you know, you're risking at least your, you know, your job, your status, your enterprise,
right,
that you control, which I think is, you know, a not unreasonable level of restraint on people's conduct. I mean, people take that kind of thing seriously,
right.
I think.
So it sounds like what you're saying is you would do everything they did on Monday, but you would add, what, a sort of declaration that we're not going to let this happen again?
A declaration that we're not
going to let things reach this size again?
Yeah, that we're not going to let things reach this size, and
right,
that we're not going to, and that we don't want to see the shakeout here come by the big banks staying big and growing at the expense of smaller, better managed institutions.
Right.
Right. I mean, because I think there's a risk here that with these sort of large institutions so in bed with the government, that the way the financial sector shrinks is that the banks that aren't getting these kind of bailouts and guarantees wind up going out of business, which,
right,
you know, it seems like both it would be a shame for them and also it would set up a system that would run well as long as everyone's paying attention, but that would create, you know, if we just have like four enormous banks that we say, I've even heard this proposal that there'll be, well, a special class of structurally significant institutions and they will be under some kind of special regulatory scrutiny and blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's great for like 2 years, but
right,
soon enough, right, normal people, you know, even eagle-eyed, policy-oriented journalists are going to start paying attention to something else. Maybe, you know, maybe Bob Kuttner will write an article about it in the American Prospect. You know, nobody will care. There'll be regulatory capture and there'll be,
right,
you know, some kind of big blow up
right,
down the road. And, you know, but that seems to be something that a sort of an elite group is very comfortable with. Because they, you know, I don't know, they're like, they know each other personally and professionally.
Right, right.
Which I guess is unavoidable, but, you know, someone right, needs to step
which
outside
is to say,
that.
Which is to say there's regulatory capture before you even start.
Right, yeah. I mean,
in that world.
Right,
right. And it's all inscrutable. I mean, you'd really have to have the, you'd really have to open the whole thing up in a way that the banking system is never going to be opened up.
Right, and then so, it doesn't
right,
work.
Right, right. No, I mean, the better way to regulate is to keep things small. I mean, it will be interesting. I mean, I think the effect of this bailout is you're going to have a number of not the traditional big investment banks, but you're going to have firms like PIMCO or Blackstone mm-hmm. That have some capital to go in that that are ready to do this. And in fact, had already proposed this. I mean, Bill Gross from PIMCO, I think, had already proposed something like the Geithner plan.
Right.
Become, you know, and those are really pretty. Those are very independent entities. I mean, they're not necessarily operating like hedge funds, but they're basically, you know, they're pretty unregulated. All of a sudden, coming in this close partnership with government, and you know, if there are a lot of them, I mean, I think that could, if there are a lot and the rules are clear, so that you're not micromanaging the institutions, you're just sort of saying, on this portfolio, your relationship, you know, here are the boundaries of what you can do and what you can't do. If it's designed well, I could see that actually leading to a whole, you know, I mean, it could lead to a world in which in 10 years, no financial institution is nearly as big as Citi was, and they're all institutions you've never heard of, you hadn't heard of before.
Right.
You know,
no,
which happens all the time. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, I'm old enough that, you know, when my friends went to work on Wall Street after college, well, the places they worked don't exist anymore. You know,
uh-huh.
They worked at places like Kidder Peabody and Lehman, which kind of disappeared and then returned. There's always this kind of churn. It's just a funny period where these things like Citi just went up, 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 up. It's not
right,
the end of the
no,
world to have a little creative destruction.
That's true. But I guess, well, I'm a little bit more skeptical than you that we'll actually steering toward that kind of happy outcome. I mean, I've felt a lot of, I felt a lot of sort of kind of dodging commentary, deploying questions about expertise and knowledge to shut outsiders out of this discussion. I'll sit, as if nobody has ever said to me when I say, like, there should be universal health care in America, nobody immediately comes back to me with, like, exactly how should you regulate such and such hospital in Kansas City. And if I can't produce an answer on the spot, I'm an idiot. Only professional hospital administrator. That doesn't happen, because we understand. Now, of course, if I shouldn't be Secretary of Health and Human Services, even if Kathleen Sebelius is Secretary of Health and Human Services, she relies on a variety of career civil servants, experts, et cetera, to do these things. But still, people can formulate judgments about principles and how things should go based on, you know, their knowledge of the political system, the political process, assessments of the world, et cetera. And there's been, I think, a lot of obscurantism erected around this whole question, starting when Paulson was in charge, continuing through to the Geithner era, as if where the functional impact has been to say that the specific people running the show must continue to run the show, and that it is incredibly vital, and that nobody can... It's not that nobody in principle can question what they're doing and their power, but in practice, nobody is allowed to, because you can't get in the room, unless you have some kind of mastery of the jargon. And I think, I've seen this happen already. I mean, long before I ever came onto the scene, in the realm of the military. Which has erected this closed universe of military personnel, congressmen who serve on the Armed Services Committee, lobbyists for defense contractors, people who work at selected think tanks, which count as credentials to become civilian people, veterans, et cetera. And debates exist within that system about what you should do, but questioning of the military-industrial complex's hegemony over a huge swath of the American economy is not allowed. And if you try to come into that conversation, someone will quickly find that you have used, like, the wrong kind of helicopter in some hypothetical example to disqualify you. And I see that same move happening in the financial world.
And of course, that's a big part of your book too, was related to the way the foreign policy establishment and their perceived expertise about the Middle East was kind of deferred to, even though that judgment was no better informed than people who knew a lot less.
Well, and I mean, it's worse than that, right? No. But it was defined in such a way so that, like, academic scholars of Middle Eastern history and politics were defined to lie outside of the circle.
Right.
And I keep seeing that. I've seen that same thing when people were like, someone was saying, well, how can Treasury staff itself unless they're allowed to bring all these Wall Street insiders in? And, I started naming some people on the blog who seem well qualified to me based on their experience in government and international institutions and academia, and some guy sent me an email and he was like, well, look at this thing Nouriel Roubini said here, and now look at this blog post by a bond trader. And it was exactly one of these things. It was like Roubini had misidentified the name of some particular class of securities. We were supposed to be, I don't know what exactly that is.
Well, I hear you. I do think, though, in all of those examples, in order to offer more than just hey, military industrial complex is too big, or hey, Wall Street is out of control, you need the connection to people who have a higher level of expertise. So, to take an example, you're now at the Center for American Progress. Somebody like Larry Korb is a vital connection between actual military expertise and a more progressive view that allows people to figure out how to be well-informed and yet challenge the assumptions of the insiders. And to take that a step further, it has been the case for years. You know, I was always part of these conversations about, you know, what kind of think tanks do we need, when CAP was created and things like that. And there was always a point where somebody would say, you know what, we just don't have enough people thinking about is really financial regulation, what's going on in financial markets, how derivatives work. There's an enormous amount of stuff happening. It has huge consequences. And we haven't built that. You know, there are economic think tanks all over Washington. There are none that really, in any kind of, that make that connection, that might have, you know, some people who had worked on Wall Street who actually could get into that, or finance, professors of finance and so forth. And I think that, you know, that remains true today. And the fact that financial journalism became so stripped down to, hey, what stock should you buy today?
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions, and Gretchen Morgenson at the Times does some of that stuff, and Roger Lowenstein is absolutely fantastic. But there was not nearly enough of the kind of journalism that would draw that out, that would sort of empower people to have opinions. I mean, you have intelligent opinions about healthcare because there's a certain amount of decent journalism about healthcare, which might require reading Health Affairs magazine in addition to, you know, Ezra Klein's blog, but, you know, it's out there, it's available, and there was, you know, going back a few years, there was really much less that could, you know, help you hook into the world of finance, I think.
No, and it is definitely true. I mean, we at CAP found ourselves, lacking a genuine expert on this. As the crisis started to unfold, I think an effort was made to, you know, go out and recruit someone, which we eventually did, but it took time because there weren't, you know, there just weren't many people
in
that space, and it's difficult to operate in that kind of environment, because you do, non-experts in Washington rely on, you know, being connected with other kinds of people through their affiliations who you can learn from.
Right, exactly. I had a point it's interesting how, you know, the few bloggers and, you know, the few people who seem to know what they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, just shot to somebody like a Simon Johnson. Have Rubini's been at it for a few years, but, you know, have just kind of shot to prominence, and we kind of rely on, without really knowing that much about them or where they're coming from or what their perspective is. You know, we kind of rely on some of these folks.
Right. Well, and it is also, I mean, I was talking about this, and specifically, you know, where is Simon Johnson coming from? And there's a certain irony. I mean, it's a double-edged irony where Johnson likes to point out that the things that the Obama administration is doing are very different from the things that Larry Summers and others were telling third world countries they needed to do.
And of course, he comes out of the IMF, so, you know, he's
right. And,
he
no,
have,
and,
he
and so,
have
and
clean
so,
hands either. Yeah.
No. I mean, I'm saying Johnson is being consistent, you know, and is saying that the U.S. financial system ought to be treated the way we said the Indonesian financial system ought to be treated, but that to people on the left, find Johnson's prescriptions appealing now as applied to the United States, but were inclined to be very critical of those prescriptions 10 years ago when they were being applied to East Asia, whereas then other people in the center who found those prescriptions great 10 years ago now find them disquieting today, which is an irony.
Yeah.
Of some kind.
Right.
That, you know, does speak to some of this, that people arrive on the radar sort of out of nowhere, get pegged as, you know, existing on one end of the spectrum when in a different context everyone would have had a
different view. The left critique of what the IMF would have advised in Indonesia or whatever. I mean, obviously a lot of it was to kind of strip down the social contract in those places, which I think we still oppose. But it was also, you know, hey, let those institutions fail, and you know, and right. move on. And I think people on the left are a little sanguine about let these things fail.
Yeah,
right. I mean, there's a sort of.
I think it's been more actually people on the right though who've been being sanguine about that or pretending to be sanguine.
Pretending to be sanguine about it. Yeah.
I would say. I mean, it's one of the signal, you know, political facts of our time. I think that has not been communicated all that well in the reporting is that you have tons and tons of Republican politicians, especially in the House, but in the Senate too, who are pretending to believe things that I don't think anyone thinks, you know, they would be doing if they were actually in a position of responsibility.
Right.
Right? I mean, if Mike Pence were Speaker of the House, I don't believe we would be implementing this kind of, like, sociopathic let all financial institutions fail.
Right.
Because no taxpayer money can be spent for anything ever. And we saw it. I mean, there was a test case. George W. Bush was president of the United States, like, 15 minutes ago, and his policies were not at all like the ones that
right.
the sort of out of power right is now claiming
right.
would be theirs. And there's been this, and you know, whatever, I mean, backbench members of the House are going to do what they do, but I think there's been a tremendous sort of irresponsibility among the conservative equivalent of, you know, the kind of roles you and I play.
Right.
In right. this, right, that they are, that people at Heritage, Cato, American Enterprise Institute, National Review, Weekly Standard are completely, you know, are letting conservative politicians get away with telling conservative base voters that, you know, fairy tales about
right.
what their policies would be, about what the consequences would be, and are not doing anything. I mean, there are a few people doing it. I think David Brooks, I think Megan McArdle are, you know, trying to speak to the right and
right.
tell them something about, you know, how the world is. But
right.
It's really distorting the sort of politics of the moment.
Right, right. Well, this is, you know, this is the American right. Very happy in complete irresponsible opposition.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that's the House Republicans, and it's, you know, and it's a lot of their commentary. It's very easy. Now, it's also true that they didn't have, of all their alliances within American capitalism, they had a weaker alliance with Wall Street than with, obviously, oil companies and, you know, small manufacturers and pharmaceuticals and all those other things. I mean, that was, it was an interesting fact of the old era
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the base of the Democratic Party within the capitalist system was really in Wall Street.
Right. Well,
and
there was sort of an East Coast and a West Coast.
Oh yeah, East Coast and West Coast.
Business Democrats.
Finance. Yeah, yeah, and,
right.
and tech as well. But
right.
and obviously entertainment. But there was much more affinity, and there was much more. You know, as Wall Streeters would sort of say, you know, we could live with paying less tax. I mean, there was. It was where you found with paying more tax, rather. It was where you found some of those affinities, and it that probably has something to do with what's going on now. Like, you know, as in, for example, your old mentor Senator Schumer.
Yes, yes, exactly. I used to be an intern in Chuck Schumer.
I had heard, for
the record.
Yeah, Schumer protege is how we identify you now.
Yes, exactly. Well, and I mean, of course, you know, the fact that the financial, elected officials are always sort of become friends with local industries, and because the financial center of the United States is located in what's become an extremely blue, you know, portion of the country,
right.
you have politicians from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. With very close, relationships with big finance, who are also, sort of linchpin members of the Democratic Party, because they have safe seats, they have, access to fundraising that they can share with others,
right.
so on and so forth, and have much more. The situation has evolved such that the. Alliance between the Michigan Democratic Party and the auto industry, you know,
right.
seems
right.
a little anomalous, whereas
right.
finance and the kind of modern-day coastal Democratic Party had really been, you know, hand in glove until
right.
recently.
Right.
Although
recently.
Still, I
recently.
Mean, Right. Well, and still, I mean, going back to my previous, concerns. I mean, it is the geographic logic of important alliances between the leaders of the Democratic Party and the leaders of major financial institutions is very compelling. You know, beyond whatever sort of might happen in the 2010 midterms.
Right.
I mean, those industries aren't going to move. Those parts of the country are not going to suddenly start loving Southern Baptists. So, I think that partnership will continue.
Right. I think that's true. Hey, so we talked about the thing that didn't come up in the press conference last night, but we haven't talked about, there was really a surprising obsession with the budget, the Congressional Budget Office estimate of the long-term deficit, and so forth. That's obviously, I looked at that and said, okay, Congressional Budget Office estimate a little different. I know how those things happen.
Uh-huh,
interesting.
Uh-huh.
Not earth-shattering. And projections are projections, but obviously it has a resonance with the D.C. press corps that maybe,
right.
Maybe I don't know why the banking stuff doesn't, but that...
Well, I mean, it mostly shows how sort of dumb everyone is. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was on when this stuff first came out. I was on the press call with Peter Orszag that they organized, and I heard who asked the questions, and like nobody from no big time DC political reporters were on that call or asked Peter Orszag any questions. Like when this came out, like when people had the opportunity to ask questions of the guy who knows what he's talking about, because it was like, well, a CBO report, who cares? Then like Republicans started making a big deal about it, so it became like the political story, and people asked these questions when they clearly, I don't know. I mean, it didn't seem to be grounded in any like concrete concerns or knowledge of this, and you can see in the fact that one of these like great charades is that I was joking that I thought Kent Conrad was going to realize that he could make his concern about the long-range deficit disappear by switching back from a 10-year to a 5-year forecasting window.
Right.
And in fact, I read in this morning's Washington Post that that's what he's doing.
Oh, that's what his new budget proposal does? Okay.
I mean, it does other things,
yeah.
But I mean, like one of the linchpins of his, I mean, he went and made it, it would be one thing if he had just come out when this came out, like me, and been like, well, it's not a big deal, that's a long time from now, we'll have to see what happens. He totally participated in this freakout about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, he has made the long-term deficit go away by not considering the long-term.
Right.
Which is
appropriate.
Exactly,
I mean, that's not...
It is appropriate. It's just that it's exactly the same as what Orszag was doing in the first place, which was showing the numbers, but kind of waving his hand about the far-out years.
Right,
and
the
saying,
numbers become less...
Less reliable.
You had a graph on your blog, I think, with the...
Right.
With
no,
the
and Doug... Right, and Doug Elmendorf at the CBO, I mean, they're trying to put together a responsible thing, which I think showed appropriate concern for the long term by putting the long term on the chart, but illustrating it with an uncertainty band.
Right.
There are
the real long term stuff, which is revenues, Medicare, basically revenues and Medicare, I'm not even going to say Social Security, is serious stuff.
It
that
is.
That you have to, obviously, the sooner you deal with it, the better, and all that. And it's not a, some of that is more certain than some of the other elements of the projection.
Right. I mean, it's, what's uncertain is the growth.
Right.
So, you can't know. But, there's both a continued unwillingness to sort of address that situation and a continued unwillingness to stop this kind of cheap bemoaning of politicians' unwillingness to address it.
Right.
If you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, to say that, like, it's pretty simple. I mean, I don't know anyone who believes that we are going to drastically cut Social Security and Medicare benefits in the long run. And you would need to actually hold that cost constant as a percent of GDP, I mean, you would need to cut them in insane ways that...
Right.
Bear no relationship to political reality. Alternatively, you could start, not like tomorrow, but 18 months from now, having, higher taxes that were not you know, that would bring in more revenue, that would not be running medium-term deficits, and that would create a situation in which we can buy time to start working on things that will slow the cost growth in Medicare. But, you know, I mean, everyone understands why politicians don't want to do that, and just sort of, like, pretending that earmarks or, you know, whatever else are going to do it, but... You know, I mean, Obama came out with a budget that, for all the sort of hand-wringing about tax increases, would, in the long run, leave revenues below where they were in the late 1990s.
Right.
So obviously you're going to have a long-term – I mean, I don't think anyone, when Barack Obama was elected, like, thought he was this big-time conservative who was going to shrink the government.
Right.
His agenda obviously implies taxes being higher than they used to be.
Right.
But his actual proposal is for them to be slightly lower. And
You can't well, because there's just not that much. Once you've set that, you know, no increase for anyone below $250,000, you're really limited in what you can do.
Right.
And you're already doing things that invite... You're already putting some things on the table that invite a lot of backlash, like the charitable deduction thing, which, you know, I love. I think that's great. You know, if you're using that to pay for healthcare, I think that's a net plus. But you get a lot of people. You suddenly create a class of enemies that you don't need.
Right, that's true. And I think
nonprofits and you know hospitals and universities and things like that.
Right. And, I mean, I do think I wrote this on the blog to the general derision of my commentaries, but I do think that the, you know, sort of American left needs to move past a kind of fixation on the progressivity of the tax code.
Right.
And to look internationally, and you see that, like, what makes for really egalitarian countries is a combination of, you know, effectively designed public services and just taxes that create enough revenue to finance effectively public services. It's not like these crazy upward sloping curves where, you know, like 70% of people don't pay any taxes. And, you know, I mean, it's a difficult adjustment, but, you know, it's part of the kind of, you know, reality of the situation is that when you are trying to get all your money from a very small but incredibly powerful group of people, that there's this enormous pushback.
That's right.
And it becomes it's created a constituency for the tax cut monomania that dominates the Republican Party.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a group of people who see themselves as the, like, I mean, it's crazy, and I don't think one really needs to sympathize with the poor rich people, but they do see themselves as, you know, being narrowly targeted by progressive politics, and so they need to fight back really vigorously.
Right. And which is why, frankly, I mean, I don't like the AIG bonuses, but I also don't like the idea of going out there and treating and using taxes as punishment.
Yeah, well,
you know, say we're just gonna kick your ass. Here's a 90% tax rate. I think that reinforces the idea that taxes are how we punish, are an act of punishing the wealthy rather than, you know, a fair way of balancing all our obligations, and those who have more are able to pay more.
You're right. No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think it was anyone's first preference to do that with the tax code. But yes, I mean, it was a.
It's all you have.
No, but it is a thing where you don't think about the full kind of symbolism of it. But I mean, particularly, you know, I understand why the administration is sort of proceeded with this the way they were, but it's hard to see exactly how the sort of Obama-style politics of taxes gets you to where they want to go.
Right.
I mean, in the long run. I mean, not just as a sort of a long term budget issue, but from what is the vision?
Right.
I think you're offering.
I think you're right, and I think that insight that you have to being aware of the progressivity of the whole social system and not just the tax code in isolation is extremely important, and it is something that's very hard to get through to people on the left. People will say the payroll tax is so unprogressive, and it is. It's not progressive. It caps out at just under $100,000 and starts on the first dollar, and it's a flat amount and so forth that you pay for Social Security. But the overall system is hugely progressive and has had hugely progressive effects. So, would I throw that out? Just if the cost was a big part of the system, I probably would. That's why I've always been very hesitant about really moving up the Social Security payroll tax to, it can be higher than it is, but I don't want people paying, $40,000 a year for a benefit that's never going to be more than $3,000 a month.
Right. Well, people need to think about, I think, in an even more systematic way than that, but that, the impact of paving streets properly and having the sidewalks function is in effect strongly progressive. Wealthy people do not ultimately have a problem leaving communities to go to, to certain kinds of subdivisions where the basic roads and public spaces are privately maintained, to sort of seceding into narrowly carved out suburbs where they don't, participate with people in other kinds of classes, to even doing things like we have in Washington, where the basic city infrastructure is underfunded and crappy, but in the downtown business area, private associations of real estate owners finance the upkeep of that kind of thing. So, people just don't normally think of, fixing potholes as having progressive distributional impact, but in general it does. I mean rich people have an enormous ability to work around any kind of shortfalls in the public sector that other people do not have. And so, doing whatever it takes to get the money to do the service as well. I mean, of course, you also need to do the service as well. It's not just money, but it is money. And whatever you're doing to make sure that that's out there, right, that people who can't hire security guards can have safe streets, is a progressive distributional policy. And, I mean, not having your kids shot while they walk to school is probably, more important to people's lives than the EITC.
I think that's huge. I mean, I think that's really well put, really, really huge. And many, there's a lot of the degree to which people with wealth actually are opting out of the public world, and it's not just public schools. I mean, I remember when I was first in D.C., which is when D.C. was really terrible. I mean, now lots of things here are actually work very, very well. But there, this was the Marion Barry era. It was awful. It was atrocious. And I remember realizing, it's atrocious, but, I actually don't need this government to do much of any. I'm all but opted out. Like, I would like there to be a functioning Medicaid system in D.C., but I don't actually happen to be on Medicaid. I'm not going to use it. Now I have a kid in D.C. public schools. Obviously I didn't then. There was just nothing I needed. This pothole. I always thought, the reason people have an attitude, the reason people say people have a bad attitude about government because of their interactions with the Department of Motor Vehicles is, for a lot of people, that is their only interaction with government.
Well, and also, you and I think we both read books and stuff like that, and if D.C. had a great public library system, might take advantage of it, but given that we don't, it's fine. I can buy books. Things get sent to me in the mail.
Review copies are your friend.
That's not the case for poor people.
Right.
Suffer from this kind of problem.
Right. It's not a bad library system.
Right, what?
It's not a bad library system.
It seemed pretty bad.
It's right around the corner. The main Martin Luther King is right around the corner from your office.
I know.
Drop by
I know all about it.
Yeah, okay.
I've been there. It's
are you on the zoning, your local zoning board now, or?
I've been to the community meetings. Oh, yeah. The library is actually really close to my house.
Oh, okay.
It was just over there. It smells really bad.
It does. It does.
Which I don't even know what the source of that problem.
Well, it's all it's Mies van der Rohe's fault.
Right, yes. It's a stinky, stinky building. Right. No, I don't mind. One of my best friends, like, led some giant campaign to maintain that building because the art crowd insists that it's a great work of genius.
Right. Well, it's one of the few buildings of that style by one of the great modern architects in D.C., so you got
to
maintain it.
So they say. Right. I guess. I don't know. I try not to question the judgments of the professional aestheticians, but it looks ugly to me.
Well, you have as much right to get into that as you do the military or the economy.
I do.
Special expertise
I
just because somebody read Clement Greenberg or something like that.
I guess, in truth, these are my family and personal connections is mostly to the arts.
Oh, so you realize, so in that case, you realize how special the special knowledge actually is,
right,
and how
right. I'm actually no the DC. Business. I'm the DC branch of the Lower Manhattan, arts elite. Just come here as a kind of a.
That is a very undignified thing to be.
it's tragic.
The equivalent of doing dinner theater in Lehigh, Pennsylvania.
Well, they think it's ridiculous for anyone to move here,
right,
or
right.
write about politics. You know how it is,
right? I do know how it is. I have those warring elements within myself.
Right. Exactly. all right. We should probably.
Yeah. Okay, Matt. Lovely to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Okay. Take care.